This hour of the program brought to you by ARP New Hampshire. Prescription drug costs continue to go up. For more information, go to ARP.org/RX. This hour also presented by the Concord Food Co-op. Dine in or shop on Concord's beautiful Main Street at the Concord Food Co-op. For more information, go to concordfoodcoop.coop.
Welcome to a special St. Patrick's Day edition of Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. In just a few moments, we'll be joined by Congressman Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, who's taking a look at running for President of the United States, and joined by our A-list panel of Dean Spotus and Wayne Lesperance here. And we'll start with you, Dean. What are you expecting from Congressman Moulton? What are you looking to talk about?
Well, I'm interested to get an initial feel about how serious he is about running for president. He was someone who had been mentioned pretty frequently and had expressed interest, and then we didn't hear as much for a while, and it's been filled now with all these other candidates getting in. So I'm interested to see what the decision process was to come in now at this point and kind of what his time frame is. I also expect that we'll talk a bit more about national security than maybe some of the other Democratic candidates, given his experience as a Iraq war veteran.
Wayne?
Here's somebody straight out of Central Casting. He's a United States Marine. He's decorated. He was an officer. He served four tours in harm's way. He brings so much to the table. It'll be interesting to see what he has to say about veterans, about national security, as Dean said. And the other question is, in sort of what lane does he see himself in among the other candidates?
And we'll see what he has to say up next. You're listening to Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. Congressman Seth Moulton is next. Welcome back. This is Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. I am Chris Rhine, Dean Spotus and Wayne Lesperance. Dean, your takeaways.
Yeah, well, it was a very, very informative session for listeners. He hit a lot of national security notes, as we expected, tried to paint a kind of a vision of a new economy that he has. He clearly seems very motivated to play a bigger role beyond being a member of the House of Representatives. And he said he'd let us know, I think, in about a month or so.
Wayne?
You know, one of the things that really took away was the breadth of policy issues that he could talk about. We talked about everything from national security to infrastructure to education to gun control, and health care, mental health care. So, you know, he's somebody who comes to us with a broad background in policy, and I think a lot of us are looking for more of that from our candidates.
Well, it was really informative and interested to see if, in fact, he does pull the trigger and get into this race. It seems like he will, but we'll have to find out a little bit later on as to if he does. This has been Pints of Politics here at New England College. This has been Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College.
This hour of the program brought to you by ARP New Hampshire. Prescription drug costs continue to go up. For more information, go to ARP.org/RX. This hour also presented by the Concord Food Co-op. Dine in or shop on Concord's beautiful Main Street at the Concord Food Co-op. For more information, go to concordfoodcoop.coop.
And welcome to Pints and Politics here at the Barley House on 139, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for Pints and Politics, which is presented by New England College. And we're very excited to be joined by Congressman Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, who has not yet announced that he is running for President of the United States, but he is here in New Hampshire. It's campaign season, and from what we understand, you're looking at running for president. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
So appreciate your time, and kind of take us through the process for you. I mean, there are 15 candidates in this race right now. What do you think that you can offer that the other candidates are not offering currently?
Well, for me, this choice really comes back to just how can I best serve the country. You know, I got here because way back in 2001, when I was graduating from college, I was influenced by a mentor of mine, the minister at Harvard down in Cambridge. He talked a lot about the importance of service. His name was Peter Gomes, and he wasn't just the minister. He was this larger-than-life moral figure on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, it's not enough just to believe in service or support others who serve. You got to get out there and do something yourself. So I looked at different options, Peace Corps, teaching overseas, but ultimately decided that I would sign up for the Marines. Now, of course, this was 2001. I had no idea that September 11th would happen a few months after I graduated, that I'd end up in Iraq and do four tours there. But over the course of those four tours in Iraq, I met some of the most amazing people in my life. And I saw the absolute best in America with some of the young people I served with. But I also really felt betrayed by some of the people who sent us there.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience with betrayal of feeling like Washington has really let you down is the same thing that I've seen as I've traveled around the country, especially over the past year, supporting a bunch of veterans that I've backed running for office. And when you go to these communities, especially places that voted for Obama but then switched and voted for Trump, mm-hmm. you feel this sense that the economy is changing faster than ever before, it's leaving us behind, and Washington isn't doing anything to help out. So that's fundamentally what draws me into this race, to looking at this. But a lot of people say, well, Seth, you know, maybe you're a little late here. I mean, there's 15 people who've already announced. Right, there are more people coming along. You know, I wasn't going to make any decision about this until I understood what it was like to be a dad, because my five-month-old, Emmy, was born in October, and it's been an extraordinary life-changing experience. We were just talking about this before we got on. And everyone says this, but for me, I like being a dad even more than I expected. But at the same time, that it's hard to leave her every week, that she changes so much every time I go to Washington for a few days, it also makes you much more invested in her future, you know, in thinking about the future of this country, because it's her future as well, not just mine. And I don't want her growing up in this world. You put that all together, and I think what we need in a candidate is someone who can actually bring this country together again, who can reach out to those places, those Trump districts, where a lot of Democrats don't even show up. Someone who can also talk about next generation ideas to solve a totally new generation of problems. You know, people aren't having their jobs taken by immigrants; they're being taken by robots. And we also need someone who can lead on national security. And of course, at the end of the day, we need someone who can beat Trump. Whether that's me or not, that's the decision I have to make. But ultimately, it will come back to, is this the best way that I can serve the country? Back in 2002, it was going in the Marines. In 14, it was running for Congress. And we'll see.
You mentioned the division in our nation, but there's also tremendous division within your party. And we're seeing that during the course of this campaign, where mostly everything is moving, you know, very far to the left. And progressives have also taken over, to a large extent, your body down in Congress as well. Is that a concern that you have, that the party and the country is perhaps moving too far from the mainstream and in your individual beliefs? And is that a rationale for running?
Well, I think the press really exaggerates the divisions in our party. I mean, we're a majority party now. We should have the majority of ideas, and that means a diversity of ideas representing people from all over this country. You know, if you think about it, we've had some real debates over health care, for example, you know, whether Medicare for All is the right solution. But fundamentally, all Democrats want to make sure that everybody in America has access to health care. We're just debating how to get there. You know, we want to make sure that every American has cheaper prescription drugs. And we're going to have a good debate about how to get there. What a change from last year in Congress, when we had the Republicans just debating about how to take health care away from Americans every single day. So Democrats are fundamentally united in our ideas. We're just going to have a vigorous debate about what policies we need to get there. I'd also point out, though, that, you know, the folks who won the majority in the House, they're people who won in Trump districts. They're people who flipped districts from Republican to Democrat. So those are the people who actually expanded our party. And leaders like Mikey Sherrill down in New Jersey, like Chrissy Houlihan in Pennsylvania, people like that are driving the debate, and they're going to be leaders in our party's future.
Dean?
Sure. Congressman, I'd like to maybe have you expand a little bit more on your position on health care, to give our listeners a sense of where you are on the spectrum from Medicare for All to single payer to let's fix Obamacare, but let's preserve the integrity of the private insurance markets. Where are you? Do you have a sense of where you are in that continuum?
Absolutely. I think Medicare should be an option for everybody, but I don't think you should be forced out of your private health care plan if that's what you want. And I speak to that as someone who has single-payer health care, because I made a commitment when I got elected to continue getting my own health care at the VA, at least until we can fix it for veterans, because I think veterans deserve the best health care in the world. And yet, as I can tell you from my own experience at the VA, they're not getting it. The VA does some things well, and I have a great primary care physician. I go there regularly for appointments, but they also sent me home with the wrong medications after I got surgery, shortly after I was sworn in. And of course, you have other stories of veterans literally dying on waiting lists for the VA. So I know what single-payer health care is like, and it's not perfect. But should it be an option? It should be an option for everybody. And should that option compete against the private sector and potentially drive down the cost and drive the bad actors in private health care out of business? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Two quick follow-ups. Some candidates in the Democratic field have suggested maybe moving the age for Medicare down to 50. So how would you feel about that? And the second second question is, we've had issues here in New Hampshire with the VA, and there's been a debate in the state about whether to invest a lot of money in revitalizing the Manchester VA, the hospital, or working on giving veterans better options in the surrounding community, so going into the, you know, private choice. Where are you on those two issues?
Sure. So on the first one, moving the Medicare age down is absolutely a step in the right direction, because again, we want to make Medicare an option for everybody, and that's a good first step. In terms of the VA, the bottom line is this: veterans deserve the best health care in the world. And if you can get that at the VA and veterans want to go to the VA, let's not forget, veterans don't want the VA to go away.
Right. Some like the VA.
Well, the majority do. A lot do. I mean, I like the VA. They do things well. I just want to make sure they're doing things better. So that should be an option. But if the best option for your health care is a private provider, hey, the bottom line is veterans deserve the best care. And if you can get it better in the private sector, then we should make sure they can.
Congressman, there was a time when a decorated Marine, somebody had served his country, as you have, somebody who's demonstrated a willingness to work across the aisle, was straight out of central casting to run for president. And so I see what might be partly behind the drive here. What's left for you to consider before you make that decision to go all in?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is, I mean, I take the quip about out of central casting, but this is not where I expected to be. I mean, I didn't study politics in school. I didn't expect to be in this position. I didn't even plan to run for Congress back when I got out of the Marines. But the reason I ran in that first race back in 2014 was because I said, you know what, if this doesn't change, if no one's willing to challenge the establishment, then it's not going to get any better. And no one today looks at government, looks at Washington, the White House, anywhere, and says, okay, they're doing a great job. Yeah, they're really knocking it out of the park. So you got to be willing to stand up to the system and change the system. But when I took on that 18-year incumbent in Massachusetts back in 2014, everybody in the Massachusetts political establishment was against me. I mean, everybody told me, not only are you going to lose, Moulton, but you'll never be involved in Massachusetts politics again because you dared to challenge the establishment. And fundamentally what they were saying to me was, Seth, do not participate in the democracy you just risked your life to defend. And that's wrong. We need to get more people to participate in our democracy. We need to make sure that every vote in America counts. And whether or not this is the right way for me to serve the country now is fundamentally how I'll look at this decision. You know, it's not about just a horse race with other people or anything. It's how can I best serve the country, and can I reach more Americans to bring this country back together after the most divisive presidency in American history?
Sure. Do you have a timeline in mind?
The next month.
Next month. Okay.
I'll make a decision within the next month.
That's great. You're going to be getting into a race, as Chris noted, with a lot of candidates. Folks like us tend to.
Wayne's quick to jump the gun. You're going to be getting in.
You're going to be getting in. Okay.
You almost jumped the gun a little bit earlier.
Should you decide? There could be a lot of. There are a lot of candidates. Should you decide to jump into the race, folks like us take a look at it and we try to put folks in lanes: the progressive lane, the moderate lane, whatever that is. Do you consider yourself a progressive Democrat?
I'm progressive on a lot of issues, and I was one of the first to sign on to the Green New Deal because I think climate change is important, for example. Now, I'm going to be talking about what I think the key components of the Green New Deal should be. I signed on when it was an empty vessel, but I'm going to lead on issues like that. I'm going to lead on voting rights. I've called for electoral college reform and abolishing the filibuster, which hardly any other candidates call for, because that's the kind of reform we need in our government. I went out and I fought for a new generation of leadership on the campaign trail last cycle. And through my organization, Serve America, we backed this incredible group of veterans running across the country, all young people who have served the country before and want to serve the country again. And we were a huge part of taking back the House. So I'm going to fight on progressive issues, but I don't prescribe to labels or whatnot, you know. And I think that we got to make sure that we reach all Americans. The Green New Deal is great, but we got to make sure we don't leave Americans behind.
One of those individuals that you supported is Morris Sullivan, who ran for Congress in a very contested first congressional district race and eventually lost to Chris Pappas. Is there some concern that you alienated potential Democratic primary voters with that support for Sullivan?
No, you know, when I came up and spoke to a group in New Hampshire a few weeks ago, there were a lot of Chris Pappas supporters there. Okay. And let's be clear, Chris is doing a great job. Mm-hmm. You know, he's doing a fantastic job representing the district. But Moore is a good friend. She's a fellow Marine, and the district literally borders mine. So I wasn't going to support folks in, you know, in Kentucky and New Jersey and California and not support my friend in New Hampshire. And that's the kind of principled look I take to politics. You know, I'm not afraid to fight tough political fights, and I'm not afraid to lose. But I thought it was the right thing to do, and now I'm proud to support Chris, and I supported him in the general election and helped make sure he got over the finish line.
It's Seth Moulton joining us for Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, special St. Patrick's Day edition. I noticed you are wearing shamrocks on your socks, so you're all in the St. Patrick's Day spirit.
In the subtle green jacket, Chris. You know.
That's very subtle green.
Credit where credit
one might
Chris
call it brown. One might call it brown. We'll call it subtle green. We're here at the Barley House, this presented by New England College. One of the areas, and Wayne talked about lanes, and you know, I think we are too much into labels, but it's not going to stop me from going into labels. In this field, I do not see many individuals. Pete Buttigieg perhaps is an individual who could do this as well, but can make an argument in regards to Donald Trump's foreign policy from a perspective that you can. And you know, I'm curious as to how you see the president's foreign policy and how you evaluate that foreign policy, and if that is the area where you view yourself having the best expertise out of anybody in the field, who you may not be in the field currently, but you could perhaps obviously be in the next couple weeks.
Well, the commander-in-chief is an utter disaster, and he's putting this country at risk. And I think most Americans know that. I think they see it around the globe, whether it's in Syria, where the Secretary of Defense just resigned over the president's Syria policy, in North Korea, where he nearly started a war, and then patted himself on the back for saving ourselves from the war that he almost started, whether it's failing to stand up to Russia, as it literally undermines our democracy, or failing to really confront the rise of China. We're talking about building a border wall on the southern border when we should be building a cyber wall to stop China from stealing our businesses.
Right.
So this president has been a failure at every step of the way. And part of the job description of the president of the United States is being effective commander-in-chief. It's making those solemn decisions about whether to send young men and women, young Americans, to risk their lives for our country. The experience that I had in Iraq in the midst of a war I disagreed with informs a lot of where I am now. I mean, I wouldn't be here as a member of Congress if not for that experience. It was the first time in my life that I really felt like America has let us down, really felt betrayed by my country. And I know a lot of Americans, a lot of troops feel let down by Donald Trump, feel betrayed by Donald Trump.
How did you balance those two things? Serving your country and disagreeing with the war? Because I think there are a number of individuals who are in the same boat as you were in. How
That's
do
right.
you serve your nation and put yourself forward in as positive a way as possible each day while also fundamentally disagreeing with the war you're fighting?
It was hard. It was really hard, and it was especially hard being a platoon commander there where I didn't have to just serve myself. I had to get a whole bunch of Americans from all over this country, you know, with different religious beliefs, different political beliefs from states across the land, to get united behind a single mission. I think that's fundamentally the job of the commander-in-chief, is to get a whole bunch of Americans with a lot of different beliefs, different political perspectives, different religious beliefs, to get united behind a single mission. But when you're in a war and you're not even sure about that mission, it is hard. What made me proud to be there was two things. One, I knew that no one was going in my place. Because that's the way wars work. It's not like if you quit, they just leave that hole empty. You know, someone else is going to fill that spot. And the second thing is that every single day on the ground in Iraq, I was able to have an impact on how that war was fought, and fundamentally just an impact on other people's lives, on the lives of fellow Marines, on the lives of Iraqis who were there. That sense of purpose that every one of us had, even though we disagreed with the war, even though many of us disagreed with the war, is something that is something I'll never forget. And as disenchanting as the war was, it was an inspiring experience to be able to serve.
Dean?
Yeah, Congressman, sticking with national security for a minute, let me ask you a question about Syria.
Sure.
So Tulsi Gabbard, a fellow veteran and an announced candidate for president, she's been criticized for engaging Assad a number of times. And on the other hand, you have President Trump saying, let's get everybody out of Syria, and now maybe they're going to leave some people. Syria is a very difficult challenge. Every candidate we speak to says that. what would be your strategy? How would you engage or not engage in Syria? And what would be the goals for you in Syria?
Sure. Well, Tulsi's a good friend of mine, though we disagree on Syria. I don't think we should be talking to Assad. But fundamentally, the problem in Syria is when you talk to the troops on the ground, they don't even know why they're there. You know, what is the mission? What are you trying to achieve? Oh, we're going to take this town back from ISIS. Okay, but then what happens next? And most importantly, what do you need to do to be able to go home? You know, even in Iraq, we can disagree with the war, but we knew what we needed to do to go home. The problem with Iraq is that we pulled out so quickly that we ended up having to send the troops back. And that's the mistake we can't make in Syria. There's no one who wants to pull the troops out of Syria more than me, having fought on the ground in the Middle East. I get how bad it is, and I want those men and women home. But we got to make sure that they can come home for good, that we have a serious plan for peace.
But
that
means what's the objective, though?
That's the point, right? Is we have to have a political objective. I want the commander-in-chief to lay out exactly what the political situation looks like in Syria when we're done. Then the troops will know what they're fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's admitting that Assad might come back to power, having a deal with the Russians, or carving out a portion of the country where our allies that have been fighting with us for the last several years can be safe, because they're about to get massacred when we leave, then that's the kind of goal that we need to.
But do you have a hunch of which one of those is right, or you're not sure yet?
Yeah, I think we should. I think probably the right answer is to carve out a space for our allies and to negotiate that. But then we can understand what we're fighting for, and we can know that when we come home, we don't have to go back.
Let's go back to cybersecurity for a second here. Americans are continuing to be told about Russia's role in the 2016 elections and perhaps even in 2018. There's been recent reports about Russian interference in European elections, Ukraine, another place that's been talked about. How secure are you that our elections are safe and free from Russian interference going into the 2020 cycle?
I'm not confident.
So what should
we haven't done enough at home, and there's basic stuff we need to do to just make sure our ballot systems are secure, that we have paper ballots backing up anything that's done electronically. But more fundamentally, we're just not willing as a country under this reckless commander-in-chief to stand up to Russia, to stand up to a country that is undermining our democracy. And this is a very real threat. It's happening every day, and it's not happening just to us. It's happening to our allies. I saw this firsthand when I went to Eastern Europe in 2015 and saw how Russia is undermining democracies in Eastern Europe. And you know what we've been doing in response? We've been conducting tank drills like it's 1950.
Right.
And so when the commander of European Command came before the Armed Services Committee just this past week, I asked him this question. I said, how much money are you spending on doing tank drills compared to investing in cybersecurity? And his answer is, we're not investing much in cybersecurity. And I said, if you have a young tank commander, like some of the guys I talked to, who realize that cyber is the real threat, but all he's given money for is buying tank fuel, can he shift and spend that money on cyber? The answer is no. So we're fighting the wrong battles on yesterday's battlefields. And that's why I'm calling for totally rethinking our national security, totally rethinking our national defense, making sure we're investing in what we need to defend ourselves about the future threats, not investing in old, expensive legacy weapon systems like we tend to do.
Right. From your position on the Armed Services, I believe, committee, what's your assessment of the U.S. military preparedness for the threats that we face as a country?
We're behind. China and Russia are starting to leapfrog us, because they're investing in ways not just to, you know, China's not competing with our 12 aircraft carriers by trying to build 14. They're just building missiles that can blow them up. And Russia's not trying to send thousands of troops through the Fulda Gap into Western Europe like in the 1980s. They're just undermining our democracy through the internet. So we got to totally rethink our national defense. And if we do that, we can probably also save a lot of money. And that's the kind of leadership that we need on national security to meet a totally new generation of threats to the United States.
Final thing here in this segment, Nancy Pelosi said that Donald Trump was not worth it in regards to impeachment and trying to quell some of the calls from progressives to impeach the president and to start that process ahead of the release of the Mueller report. Do you agree with her?
Well, I don't want to speak for the speaker, but I'll tell you where I am on this. Congress does two things. We debate things and we vote on things. And they're two separate things and they're both important. You know, the Republicans like to just vote on things without even having any debate. We got to show as Democrats that we're willing to do both. And I think right now is the time to be debating this stuff. I mean, any American can look at what Trump is doing in the Oval Office and see there's some real questions here, folks. And we got to debate whether we should be moving towards impeachment. That's a debate we shouldn't be afraid to have. Now, I do think we should postpone the vote until the Mueller report comes out. Mm-hmm. But we should be having that vote right. We should be having that debate today. There's the list is too long of the things that Trump has done that give us a moral obligation, a constitutional obligation, to have that debate in Congress today.
That is Seth Moulton, Congressman from Massachusetts, joining us here for Pints and Politics at the Barley House St. Patrick's Day edition, which is presented by New England College. We'll take a brief break and come back with more after this.
This hour of the program brought to you by ARP New Hampshire. Prescription drug costs continue to go up. For more information, go to ARP.org/RX. This hour also presented by the Concord Food Co-op. Dine in or shop on Concord's beautiful Main Street at the Concord Food Co-op. For more information, go to concordfoodcoop.coop.
Welcome back. This is Pints and Politics here at the Barley House at 139, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints and Politics presented by New England College. I'm Chris Ryan, joined along with Dean Spotis and Wayne Lesperance by Congressman Seth Moulton here for Pints and Politics at the Barley House. There was an interesting comment on the campaign trail in Iowa the other day from Beto O'Rourke, who compared individuals who were fighting climate change to those who stormed the beaches at Normandy. And I'm interested in your feelings on those comments.
Well, I wouldn't put them in the same category, but I do think that every generation has a big issue to fight for, you know, and it requires Americans to stand up across the country to volunteer, to get engaged. And there are a lot of Americans who think like I do that climate change is an issue of our generation, that mm-hmm. we're the generation that will either consign this planet to going out of existence or save it for future generations. I think about this a lot as I'm actually one of the only members of Congress with a degree in science. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, I believe in science, which mm-hmm. some people in Congress don't seem to believe in. And it is really important. I also think about it because of my daughter, because I want to make sure that she has a planet to grow up in. Mm-hmm. That we leave her a world that you can inhabit. Someone just gave me a book called, I think it's like The Uninhabitable World or something like that, about how we're about to just literally put this planet out of business. And so we do have to stand up. We do have to get engaged. We do have to fight. But I'll tell you, the sacrifices, the unbelievable courage that it took those Americans to storm the beaches of Normandy, that's pretty unique.
How dangerous is hyperbole, in your view, amongst Democratic presidential candidates, whether it's, you know, making promises in regards to policy or, you know, making that comparison? Do you think the Democratic primary candidates have to be careful in how they categorize things? Or in the era of Trump, you know, are all bets off? I mean, you say what you want, and that's the game now.
No, all bets aren't off, because we're going to be the party that actually believes in the Constitution, that believes in integrity, that believes in real leadership. You know, one of the first lessons that I learned in the Marines is that you can fail a run, and they'll let you run the next day and try mm-hmm. again. You can fail a test, and they'll let you retake that test. But if you lie about anything, you're gone that afternoon. That's the basic level of integrity that we should expect of everyone who serves, and certainly of our commander-in-chief. And we've got to set that example on this side of the aisle. I don't think you beat Trump by out-Trumping him. I think you beat Trump by reminding Americans what this country is really about, but the values that have gotten us here today, that are values that have seen us through fights like storming the beaches of Normandy, and the values that will see us through this fight with climate change. That's what we need to be all about. And anyone who just stoops to Trump and says, oh, the rules have changed, I I don't think that's where we need to take this country.
Congressman, let's talk a little bit about economic policy. So right across the street at the State House, control of the state legislature in the midterm election switched from Republican to Democrat. We still have the same Republican governor. And this week, our Democratic state legislature has been busy, A, voting to roll back Governor Sununu's business tax cuts, and B, to have a minimum wage. Right now, New Hampshire just relies on the federal minimum wage of 7 1/4, and they want to step rise it up to $12 by 2021. So at the national level, we hear a lot about billionaire tax increases and tax policy and minimum wage. And those two issues, tax cuts, minimum wage, where are you at the national level?
Sure. So first of all, on tax cuts, I think the president's tax cut has been an utter disaster. He called it tax reform. It's just been a pure tax cut, and it's almost all going to the rich. We got to make sure that everybody in America pays their fair share. Now, I don't think that Bill Gates, who's led the fight against poverty and AIDS in Africa and everything else, is a villain. I don't think he needs to be punished because he's been successful. And that might be a place where I differ from some other candidates or potential candidates. But I do believe that everybody's got to pay their fair share. I also believe that it shouldn't just be a minimum wage. It should be a living wage. And that means that the minimum wage is different in different states. The cost of living is different in New Hampshire compared to Nevada or Mississippi or Massachusetts.
Sure.
And so what we need to make sure is that if you have a good paying job, if you have a job where you're working hard, that you get enough pay to support your family. To basically just to be able to make ends meet, to make sure your kids are fed. And maybe,
more than
725. A couple times once a season, go on a vacation, and that's more than 725. Absolutely.
Yeah. A quick follow up on taxes. In the 2016 cycle, we did a number of these events with Bernie Sanders, and Bernie always uses that phrase, "Make people pay their fair share." But whenever I would ask him, "How do you determine what a fair share is?" There's no real specific algorithm or definition. So when you say, and I think all Democrats have picked up that language in the primary now, how do you determine what a fair share is for somebody who's wealthy?
Well, first of all, they need to just be paying the taxes that they're supposed to pay. And right now, a lot of people in America, the people who can afford these fancy tax consultants, are just getting out of paying taxes, period.
Paying zero taxes.
Paying zero taxes or putting their assets overseas or whatever else. That's the kind of stuff that we need to make illegal right away. We've got to make sure that everybody pays the taxes they're supposed to pay. That's the first step. And the second step is if you had a lot of opportunities in America, you should be asked to give a little bit more back. Right now, Social Security has a cap where people above a certain income don't have to contribute anymore to Social Security. That's going to go away. Come on, folks. If you make more money, you should contribute more to Social Security. That's not that hard.
Go ahead, Wayne.
This week, the world bore witness to a tragic incident in New Zealand with the shooting and the loss of life of so many folks there. Unfortunately, that's something that Americans are all too familiar with in our own country. I wonder, for you, is this a gun control issue? Is this a mental health issue, or is it both?
Well, first of all, it's a hate crime. Let's call it for what it is. It's an absolute hate crime. And it is another case of white supremacy turning into abject terrorism. It is a terrorist act, a hate crime, and we've got to be clear about that right from the beginning. Now, does gun control help? Yeah, it does. Gun reform helps. And I'm not talking about gun reform that violates the Second Amendment. I'm talking about the things that the vast majority of Americans agree with, like making sure we have background checks on guns. Making sure that everybody who buys a gun has the same background check. Like, that's not that hard. And 95% of Americans agree with me on that. I have a bill in Congress to prevent terrorists from buying guns. I mean, my gosh, what a controversial idea. We're not going to have terrorists buy guns, right? And yet you wouldn't believe the NRA is opposed to this. So there's common sense reforms that the vast majority of Americans agree with that are not going to prevent every tragedy. And I get the fact that New Zealand has tougher gun laws than we do. Not going to prevent every tragedy, but will help. Will make a difference. Will save some young people's lives. And we've got to have the political courage to get that stuff done.
I want to continue and go. Oh,
just,
Wayne,
just the mental health aspect of that, though. We often have the conversation about gun control, gun reform, but almost always, especially in the incidents here in the United States, we find out the backstory of the folks who perpetrate these things. And more often than not, I would say that mental health issues are part of that calculation. Should there be more being done and more mandated federally to support mental health care?
Without question. Without question. I mean, we invest pennies on the dollar in mental health care compared to other medical, you know, challenges and priorities. Mm-hmm. There's just still this stigma against mental health care, and this is something that I've thought about a lot and faced a lot as a veteran. You know, post-traumatic stress is very real. I've had post-traumatic stress, and I have a lot of friends who've had it. And I've lost two Marines in my platoon since we've been back. One of them was a hero of mine. African-American young man from Alabama, first in his family to leave the state. And his father never even been on an airplane. And he was a real hero in Iraq. When another kid, Ryan from Vermont, was hit by a grenade in a building we were in. James was his name, from Alabama. James put Ryan on his back and ran through withering machine gun fire to take him to safety. Ryan wouldn't be alive today. Ryan from St. Johnsburg, if not from James Hassel from Alabama. And James came back, and after that incredible experience, he said, I want to keep saving lives back home. And so he went to nursing school so he could work in an ER and literally help save lives every single day. He did well at nursing school. He got a great job. But he had post-traumatic stress. I mean, frankly, if you'd gone through what I just described, you'd probably have post-traumatic stress too. And so he went to the VA. But rather than give him the counseling that he needed, the VA just sent him home with drugs. So many pills that just by taking the pills he was prescribed, James died of a heart attack at the age of 30. That's not taking care of mental health. And post-traumatic stress is a great example of a mental issue that is curable. I know a lot of vets who've gotten through post-traumatic stress, including myself. So we can fix this, but we need to be invested in it, and we're not.
That is Seth Moulton joining us here on Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. And certainly mental health and mental illness is an issue that is really a significant one across our nation, and also at times is tied into economic situations with middle class and working class families. And you know, as a result of that, we see a lot of those families vote Republican in one election, Democrat in the next, because they want hope. They want something that's going to change the climate of their communities economically, and also change the trajectory of our nation from an economic standpoint. You talked before about where those jobs have gone, and robotics and the 21st century workforce and economy. As a potential candidate and as a congressman, what do you see as being the future in regards to the economy? And what has to be done from the Oval Office to bring this nation to where it needs to be?
I think that every American should have a meaningful job in the new economy, not just the old. And that means that Donald Trump's solution of going back into the coal mines, of erecting walls to keep out the immigrants who are supposedly taking our jobs, when I think most Americans know that it's not immigrants but robots that are taking jobs. Jobs are just being automated out of existence.
But how do we build the robots where they are? The robots are not the robots aren't going.
Oh, they're not going away.
We need to build our jobs around the robots. So how do you do that?
So what that means is, what it means when I say that every American needs to have a job opportunity in the new economy, mm-hmm. not just the old. That means that we need to invest in things like vocational school, mm-hmm. where, look, computer programmers are actually starting to get automated out of existence. That's called machine learning, when mm-hmm. computers program themselves. But you know what's not going to get automated anytime soon? An electrician. The lights in this bar go out, and we need someone to go dig into the electrical cabinet. There's no robot that's going to do that anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And in America, we need to show that not only are we going to give you an opportunity to go to vocational school and help you pay for it, but that work is valued, that work matters. Sort of like Germany, where it doesn't matter if you're a butcher or electrician or you're a computer scientist, they value that career. We respect folks. I mean, and God knows there are opportunities. I mean, have you tried to get an electrician lately? They're making a lot of good money.
Air conditioning, they're making a lot of good money.
But we have this stigma in America against those great jobs. So Democrats talk a lot about free college and how everybody should go to college. I don't think everybody should go to college. I think everybody should have the opportunity to go to college. I want my daughter to have the opportunity to go to college. But you know what? If my daughter wants to be an electrician, I want her to be able to pursue that dream too, and I want her to be respected for that job.
Dean?
Let's stick with education for a moment again, just to get a better sense of where you are. This big debate among candidates about public university, and you know, you have, again, you have a spectrum here from, you know, Bernie Sanders and free public university. Others, as Hillary Clinton back in 2016, was debt-free public university, which is a little bit different than making it just outright free. And then a range of other programs dealing with shutting down for-profit diploma mills and tinkering with ways to alleviate student loan forgiveness or student loan debt. Where do you see yourself in that range of programs?
Well, first of all, just to be clear about where I stand, I'm still paying my college loan. So I get student debt,
yes.
All right? And that's a real problem. It's a burden on students. It's a burden on families. It's a drag on our economy because there's money I could be spending in our economy every day if I didn't have to write that student loan check every month. So I get that. But I want to make sure Americans also get this. 20% of America doesn't even graduate from high school right now. They're not worried about paying for college. They just don't even get out of high school. And those are some of the folks that we're leaving behind with this economic change. So we can talk, we can have a good debate in the Democratic Party about free college or debt-free college or whatever that means. But let's make sure that we're reaching every American, that every American has an opportunity to get an education for a job that's meaningful in this new economy. And that means making sure more Americans graduate high school and making sure that if you want to go to college, you have the opportunity to go to college and it won't burden you with debt for the rest of your life. But also, if you want to go to vocational school, you know, if you want to serve your country or serve your community in a different way, you're going to be valued and respected for that kind of work as well. I think it's time for a total rethink of our education system. That's what we did in the Industrial Revolution. When the Industrial Revolution took people out of farms and put them in factories, we started universal high school. And that hasn't turned out to be entirely universal, but that's what we started. We said, the old system isn't going to work. Well, the economic change that is happening right now is happening even faster than the Industrial Revolution. So I think, you know, debating around the edges of who's going to pay for college and whatnot is actually missing the big opportunity here and the big challenge. We got to totally rethink our education system from the ground up to meet the challenges of the new economy, not the old.
Wayne, one more thing briefly.
Let me just talk to you about something that hardly ever comes up on the campaign trail, on the primary system, but I think it's one of the more important issues we face as a country. That's infrastructure. When we're talking about being a global player in the economy, we're talking about airports, roads, ports, and bridges, and everything that goes into moving products, goods, and services around. Every study we see talks about a crumbling infrastructure, and yet, aside from some token speaking to those issues, there really hasn't been that kind of massive national approach to trying to get us competitive again in terms of our infrastructure. So what are your thoughts on infrastructure?
No, there hasn't been. And Wayne, not to call you out, but there's two things that you did mention in your list of infrastructure that are about 21st century infrastructure. Things like broadband, high-speed rail, ways to get to jobs faster.
Do you believe in universal broadband? Should that be a...
Absolutely. It doesn't matter where you live, whether you live in a small town, on a farm, in rural America, or you live in the middle of a big city. You should be able to compete for the same jobs on the internet, and right now you can't because broadband access is totally unequal. It was just like the 1920s and 30s when not every American had electricity. And the federal government, people on both sides of the aisle got together and said, everybody deserves electricity in America. Well, broadband is the new electricity. If you don't have broadband, you can't compete. You can't be a member of our modern society. So we need to make sure that everybody in America has broadband. We also need to make sure that, you know, if the closest job is a three-hour drive away, so you can't get there. I mean, this is why China's building high-speed rail, so that you can commute to that job in 30 minutes, not a three-hour drive. High-speed rail isn't just about this fancy new thing that like only works in the Northeast Corridor or something like that. It's about 21st century infrastructure to compete in a new economy and make sure that you can access jobs no matter where they are.
Just a quick clarification or follow-up. There was some initial movement towards infrastructure early in the Trump administration. He had talked about our airports being run down, et cetera. But almost immediately we fell into this debate between Republicans and Democrats. Democrats said there needed to be major federal dollars invested in infrastructure, and Republicans said, no, it needs to be done through investment incentives for private industry to take up the infrastructure expansion. How would you see paying for a major infrastructure program? Federal dollars, incentives, a combination?
It should be a combination, but we've got to come to terms with the fact that there's got to be a lot of money invested. When the economists got to work on President Trump's plan, what they said is really it's just going to make it cheaper to do the projects that are already planned. It's not going to invest in any new infrastructure. And we're not going to compete with China and the rest of the world if we have an old-fashioned infrastructure. Sure, we got to fix our bridges, but that's like the bare minimum, folks. We got to make sure that you have water that you can drink, whether you're in Flint, Michigan, or Concord, New Hampshire, or wherever. But that's the bare minimum. If we want to compete in the new world, we've got to have a 21st century infrastructure system.
In conclusion, we heard Elizabeth Warren describe Theodore Roosevelt as being kind of an ideal running mate. There's been a movement towards Franklin Roosevelt. In your view, who is the president that you most admire and that you would see yourself? Theodore Roosevelt's right behind me over here. He's watching over my shoulder, as always.
Well, I don't know if I have a favorite, but I'll tell you.
Who would you most want to aspire to be?
Well, you know what? Teddy Roosevelt's right there on the wall looking at us. And there's a few things that Teddy Roosevelt did that I think are really appropriate to today. The first of which is that he was not afraid to stand up to the establishment, to the business establishment back then, to a totally new economy dominated by big players and say, we got to make sure this economy works for everybody. That was central to what he was doing. He was also someone who had the courage, you know, to take on folks in his own party. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of political courage that we need from a next generation leader. I think we also need someone who fundamentally can bring the country together. And Teddy Roosevelt, in the end of his career, he said that neither party was doing it for him, so he formed his own party. It wasn't ultimately successful, but the point is that he wanted to reach Americans where they are. He wanted to reach out to all Americans and say that when all this is over, when we elect our next president, it's got to be someone who can bring us all together again. Trump has been the most divisive president in American history. He has played into divisions between rich and poor, rural and urban, and everything else, white and black, that are starting to tear this country apart. But that's not who we are at our best. You know, America has always been a work in progress. And I'm someone who, despite all our challenges, is proud every single day to be an American. I'm as patriotic as they come. I believe in this country. Not because we figured it all out. You know, from our sordid history of slavery to black kids who are afraid of getting shot every time they walk down the street by cops today, we haven't figured out race in this country. From kids who couldn't get a fair education in segregated schools in the South in the 1950s to kids who go to segregated schools by both race and class today, we haven't figured out education in this country. From poor and middle class families who couldn't get access to good health care 20 years ago to poor and middle class families who still can't get access to health care today, we haven't figured out health care. But we're not a country at our best that thinks we figured it all out. We're a country that thinks that we might.
Yeah, the idea of America.
The idea of America. The idea that we're going to work on making it better. And the best people who get into politics, the best people who go and serve in our nation's wars, who serve in our military, who risk their lives, they don't go because it's all perfect. They don't go into a perfect political system or a perfect war. They go in because they can make it better, because they can make a difference, because their vote, their life matters. That's when America's at our best.
Congressman Moulton, thanks so much for your time. We look forward to your decision regarding looking at running for President of the United States, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks.
This is Congressman Moulton joining us here for Pints and Politics at the Barley House at 139-1450 and nhtalkradio.com, presented by New England College. Welcome back. This is Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. I am Chris Rhine, along with Dean Spotis and Wayne Lesperance. Dean, your takeaways.
Yeah, well, it was, I think, a very, very informative session for listeners. He hit a lot of national security notes, as we expected, tried to paint a kind of a vision of a new economy that he has. He clearly seems very motivated to play a bigger role beyond being a member of the House of Representatives. And he said he'd let us know, I think, in about a month or so.
Wayne?
You know, one of the things that really took away was the breadth of policy issues that he could talk about. We talked about everything from national security to infrastructure to education to gun control, and health care, mental health care. So, you know, he's somebody who comes to us with a broad background in policy, and I think a lot of us are looking for more of that from our candidates.
Well, it was really informative and interested to see if, in fact, he does pull the trigger and get into this race. It seems like he will, but we'll have to find out a little bit later on as to if he does. This has been Pints of Politics here at New England College. This has been Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College.